She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Hello, everyone. Gina Murphy Darling here, and this is Mrs. Green's World, where we are disruptors for good. We're game changers, doing the good thing, the right thing, not just for ourselves, but for all beings who call the earth home. Thank you so much for listening and for being a part of our world. And for doing that, you become a disruptor for good and inspire all of us to do the good thing and the right thing. A big shout out and thanks to the sponsor of this show, the Chapman Automotive Group. As a company, they are committed to doing their share and showing they care about their employees, about their community, and about the planet. Their Community Green Team is actively involved in year-long activities that impact both the internal operations of the company and all of their locations, as well as their community through their hands-on philanthropy. They're doing a lot to make a difference for the planet. For more information about Chapman, please visit chapmantucson.com, and I hope you will check them out. I'm very excited about this show today for a lot of reasons, and I'm not quite sure if excitement captures the word. I think I even feel somewhat of a heaviness in my voice, and I want to convey that heaviness and the joy and the hope all in one. But right now, what I'm feeling is that heaviness, and I'm so transparent it comes through. But this is the first of a five-part series of that we're doing, spotlighting women leading the charge to address global warming. And we believe that there's no better moment to accelerate the cause of gender equality around the world than by raising the voices of brilliant women who are creating positive change by doing the good thing, the right thing, for all of us who do call this planet home. Joining us for this next hour to launch our series is Faith Jamil. And Faith, did I say it right? When we talked earlier, I wanted to know if it was a hard G or a soft G.
Soft G. Soft Gimel.
Gimel. Okay, so sorry for that. Executive Director of Resisting Environmental Destruction on Indigenous Lands, Red Oil. And Red Oil is a grassroots network that was created by Alaska Natives to share knowledge, experience, and strategies to address the detrimental impacts of fossil fuel, mining, and climate change in Alaska. Faith is a member of the Gwich'in tribe, an Arctic village in northeast Alaska above the Arctic Circle. She is an earth defender, a campaign organizer, and a public spokesperson, and is a board member of the Indian Treaty Council, and really works a lot in terms of with the press and a tribal liaison, and she is also a human rights activist. So Faith, thank you so much for being here. And, you know, more importantly, it's great that you're here, but I want to thank you for all the work you're doing to make a difference and raise the consciousness for the planet about the rights of Indigenous people. Thanks for spending the time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited. So I'd like to start with the macro. Tell us about where you're from, about your sacred land, where is it, and why it's a place on the planet that's so important and so worthy of interest and preservation. The big picture from Faith.
Well, sure. I am Nitz Aigwitch in Pitt River and Wintu, and I was raised in Bushrike Ol, Arctic Village, Alaska. It's northeast Alaska, and we're located right adjacent to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Our community is a small community, about 110 miles above the Arctic Circle, and we live a land-based subsistence lifestyle. We still hunt, we still fish, we still gather to survive in our homelands. And this is where I was raised. I was raised living that lifestyle And our lifestyle is very dependent upon the porcupine caribou herd. And the caribou gives birth to their young in the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And so when you hear about the issue of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and oil drilling there, the place that they want to drill, and it's every major oil company in the world, they're targeting, it's the birthplace and nursery of the porcupine caribou herd. And it's called the 1002 area, which is the last 5% of America's Arctic coast that's still protected from oil and gas development, or was until recently, where Congress made a decision to, through the tax bill late last year, to seek revenue from oil drilling within the coastal plain under the Trump administration. And that area to the Gwich'in people, it's sacred. We call it Izhikwitzangwintaygotlit. It means the sacred place where life begins. And it's not only sacred to the Gwich'in because it's the birthing grounds of the caribou, but it's an important ecological area on the North Slope for its critical habitat for all other species. 156 migratory birds, species of migratory birds from around the world fly up there every spring and they nest in that area. It's also one of the last and most important on-land denning areas for polar bears. And when people talk about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, this small piece called the 1002 area by the oil companies and Congress is the biological heart of the Arctic Refuge. And it's the place that's been under most contested for or against oil and gas development for the past 40 years.
So in the past 40 years, and I'm kind of like, I don't even know what to say. It's very interesting to me that it was passed as part of the tax bill. And we can only begin to imagine other things that got just like snuck in there that will be devastating. I want to understand the revenue that oil companies will generate from that. From that destruction and devastation will be taxed, and that will help support the tax bill. So that's, did I get that right?
Yes.
Okay, so very small amount of people, literally individuals and, you know, shareholders will get to see some benefit of that, but it's a very small amount of people. And since that happened, has there been any action? I mean, is there a general global reaction against it and making sure it's stopped in the courts? What's happening right now?
So the reason that this issue was tucked within this must-pass tax bill was because Congress has debated this issue for over 40 years.
Jeez.
And every time there is a debate on the issue, they always vote against drilling in the refuge because the merits of the issue are so strong.
Got it.
And that's why this issue was tucked into a must-pass bill where there was no debate allowed on the merits of the issue. And it was a must-pass bill under Republican Congress, and it was a way for Alaska senators to achieve their goals.
Alaska senators that want it to pass, that want to drill. Wow.
And so the Gwich'in Nation, we have stood and fought against this development for over 40 years. And when this passed, we were not surprised, but it is stimulated within our leadership more of the, we're going to stand up against this. This is just one venue, congressional venue. Now we may look at legal action and other tactics to try to protect this area. But it's very clear that the Gwich'in Nation were not standing down. And we're not going to give up the fight. And we want all Americans, because everyone has a say what happens to that area. It's federal land. It's a national wildlife refuge. Public land. So everyone has a say what happens there. And we want America to stand behind us. And hopefully, when we have a new administration, they will realize what a mistake that was and undo that decision.
Before it's too late. And I had a friend of mine stay with me recently from the EPA, and she was talking about Bears Ears in Utah and the uranium mine and how they cut out, literally, it's cut out so that the land that was released for public access, quote-unquote public access, is it just follows the lines of the uranium mine. And as she explained to me, once that's mined, like, that area's done. It's done. It's not like we can grow it back or put some trees on it or make it look pretty. It's finite. It's finished. And that's when what you're describing is you can't put it back in the ground. It's done. And areas will be devastated, right, and wildlife will die. And that's what I wonder if people don't understand that. And, oh, by the way, 40 years ago, we might have needed oil. Probably not. Right now, we don't need oil. We don't need to extract. We don't need that oil. So there's no earthly reason other than greed and profit to extract it. Is that fair of me to say that?
Yes, that's fair, and that's the truth. But in the state of Alaska, our leadership in the state, our congressional leadership, our state leadership, they want to continue to extract and exploit the resources. And they're not looking towards any transition right now away from fossil fuels. And that's why the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge has been under threat by the state of Alaska, because we're a resource state. Alaska is a resource state.
Right.
They have not made a plan to wean from the resources to another economy. And so if you turn on the television in Alaska, watch their show or whatever, there's always commercials, and they're constantly banging the drum to drill for more oil. Anywhere that there is oil, we need to get that resource. That's the cry in Alaska. It's like the sky is falling if we don't drill for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge or in the National Petroleum Reserve or in the Outer Continental Shelf of Alaska. And that's being drilled into everyone's psyche to where people think that we actually do need to do that to survive. But you and I know we don't.
We don't. And it's a fear tactic. It's fear and lying. I mean, that's exactly what it is, and so unnecessary. And when you look about this country, the sustainable jobs and the biggest growth in this country were in green jobs and solar. And you get a lot of sun. It's just like, it's just, you know, there's no rational, authentic, truthful way to address that. It's really about greed, and they're using fear, which is not unusual. Make them believe that there's something to be scared of, and people want to protect what they think is going to hurt them. So in the picture of, you know, the real impact and the alarm bell about global warming, which there's the destruction of the habitat forever, and I want to say that forever, like we will not be bringing the caribou back. That's not going to happen if the land is destroyed. It's done. They're done. There's no place for them to come there. What's Tell me about the alarm bell. It's not coming. It's happening right now. Describe what's happening in Alaska in general in terms of the impact of global warming.
Yeah, in my community, my elders, the reason we took such a strong position on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the Gwich'in Nation took a political position in 1988 to stand and speak out for protecting this area. We have 15 communities in Northeast Alaska and Northwest Canada. We're an international tribe, and all of our communities stand together, united, with one voice to speak out against that development. But one of the reasons was our elders and our people back then could foresee what was coming now with global warming. Global warming was one of the primary reasons why we took such a strong stand. And so now in Alaska, everything that our elders at home predicted was coming, it's our reality. And this is throughout the state of Alaska. Most Alaska Native communities still live a land-based lifestyle, a subsistence lifestyle of hunting, fishing for survival. And for us to live that lifestyle and to continue our ancient lifestyle, our land has to be intact because that's where we survive from. That's our food security. Right now, what's happening in Alaska, and we know this is because of the burning of fossil fuels, and it's a major human cause of emissions that are resulting in global warming. We know that now, right?
Right.
What's happening in Alaska is we have devastating and alarming weather patterns. All of these altered weather patterns create more severe storms, which is causing more severe erosion of coastal areas. We have greater precipitation, thawing permafrost, where the ice, the permafrost beneath our feet is literally melting. We have melting sea ice. Our glaciers are receding. And we have a more increased spruce bark beetle infestation, which is also causing more severe forest fires. And the forest fires in the summertime are so severe that actual communities have been emergency evacuated in the summertime. We have declining populations of fish and migratory and habitat disruptions of key subsistence resources. So all natural cycles of life have been disrupted. And what's happening is when these impacts happen, it's leading to a loss of our subsistence resources and our rights, relocation of our communities, and negative social statistics related to human health. So the major impacts right now is there are communities that are facing forced relocation because their coastlines are no longer protected by sea ice and have eroded to where they're basically caving off into the ocean. And they need to be relocated immediately. It is a crisis situation, and no one wants to be accountable to those communities and foot the bill.
No one ever even hears about it. It's like it's not even news. You know what I mean? It's like I follow this, but you're talking about ground zero. And I didn't mean to interrupt. I apologize. But it's like this is ground zero in our country, in the United States of America, real upfront happening. And that's not making the nightly news. So we have 1 minute till break, which is always rather surprising to me because I'm sitting here listening. But we have a lot more time on the show and a lot more to talk about because I'd really like to hear about that. This is really what I would call and I wanted you to just, you know, curate my comments about, is this really climate genocide? Are we talking about real climate refugees? You hear about them in Syria and in Africa and other parts of the world. But this is the United States of America. So everybody stay here with us. More from Faith when we come back in about 30 seconds.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
And welcome back, everybody. I am Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for joining us. Before we get on with this incredible show, just a quick question. Did you know that you can become a member of Mrs. Green's World? Find out more about what being a member means and about getting access to behind-the-scenes content and fun, informative videos. You can do that by visiting MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member. And we really hope you do because we think you'll really enjoy being on the inside and knowing what's happening on Inside Edition. Joining me for this hour is Faith Gamill. She is the Executive Director of Resisting Environmental Destruction of on Indigenous Lands, called Red Oil. Very powerful concept there. It's a grassroots network that was created by Alaska Natives to share knowledge, experience, and strategies to address the detrimental impacts of fossil fuel, mining, and climate change in Alaska. Faith is a member of the Gwich'in tribe in Arctic Village in northeast Alaska, above the Arctic Circle. She is also a board member of the International Indian Treaty Council and is a public spokesperson, press and tribal liaison, and human rights activist. Faith, thanks once again for being here and for your courage in taking this all on and being at the forefront on many fronts to raise awareness about this. So let's talk about it. Am I being a drama queen by saying this is really, these are climate refugees in America, that it's climate genocide? Is that too strong a phrase for what might happen?
No, that's an accurate phrase. And we are in crisis in Alaska. As I stated earlier, the ground is literally melting beneath us. And in the summertime, in our cold region, we're burning up in Alaska. And we do have climate refugees. That's a reality. Three communities right now need to be relocated immediately. It is a crisis situation. No one wants to foot the bill. The oil companies are not taking responsibility to help these communities. Neither is the federal government. Neither is the state of Alaska. And so people are becoming climate refugees. According to statistics, all the coastal communities in Alaska, there will be about 80 communities in the future that will need to be relocated.
80?
Right now we have, yes.
Wow.
Right now we have three. And it is genocide because people are dying from climate impacts. In Alaska, we have to hunt to get our food. We have to travel on the ice to hunt. And we are losing people in our communities. Some years, we've lost people because there's no more ice when they're traveling. We've lost people to the ice. This is reality. And no one talks about that. The only time I've ever heard that term was when I was in Paris and a woman from the Maldives stated that term. This is climate genocide. People are actually losing their lives, and we cannot allow more lives to be lost. And so it's an urgent situation in Alaska and around the world.
So it is, it is. And to me, there's the whole thing about that I learned from my parents, that charity begins at home, and it's not charity, it's taking care of each other, to me. So I don't really want to use that phrase, but taking care of each other, we should be taking care of our American citizens, people from our country. And Faith, I guess one of my questions is, for the relocation, it's a rabbit hole that I go down in terms of, yeah, the ice is melting and it's going to continue to melt. So what are some of the ideas out there about where will these villages be relocated to? It's not like moving a banker and they go to another city and get a job as a banker. These people fish to live, they hunt to live, they use the skins of what they hunt for their clothing. It's a very, very connected to the land survival. So what's the vision for if they do get moved and there was an opportunity for the federal government to step up? What are some of the thoughts about relocation and livelihoods?
At this time, the communities that are on the list to be relocated, they've created their relocation plans.
Got it.
Which is the best
yes.
way.
Yes, yes.
Because they can choose where to be relocated that would mirror where they are now, and hopefully not disrupt their lives so much.
Got it.
As much.
Right.
But it's not by choice. I mean, they are rooted to their environment. That's their home.
Forever.
So it's very, very hard.
Yeah.
And emotional to have to leave and move your whole community. And I can't imagine it. I'm from an inland community. We're surrounded by mountains. I can't imagine having to move our whole community. But there are places in Alaska that are dealing with that.
Truly.
And that's the most severe impact of climate change that we see where in Alaska. But there's all these other impacts. And these impacts are compounded by the fact that the state of Alaska, the federal government, multinational oil companies, and corporations, even Alaska Native corporations, are continually targeting our homelands for further energy and resource extraction. So on one hand, we're impacted by massive climate change. And on the other hand, we're fighting to defend our homelands from resource extraction, which also is devastating and would harm our way of life and our food security. And that's what's happening in Alaska. That Alaska is ground zero, not just for climate change, but also United States energy policy. We have places like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Beautiful places. Places that are unique. You will never find anywhere around the world that the oil companies are trying to gain access to. Such as beyond the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the oil companies and the federal government under the Trump administration, they have rolled back protections that were put into place by the Obama administration, which would protect Arctic waters from oil and gas development. The Trump administration is now seeking to roll those protections back to drill in the Beaufort Sea, the Chukchi Sea, the Gulf of Alaska, and nearly all the waterways surrounding the state of Alaska besides one area. And the area that they're not trying to drill is Bristol Bay, North Aleutian Basin, because that was set aside under a moratorium. But everywhere else, our waterways currently are under threat under the U.S. 5-year plan. So the fight that we had when we got Shell Oil to pull out of the Arctic is not over. It's going to start again. And we're going to have to fight again to protect the oceans in Alaska. And the funny thing is, the reason why the oil companies are targeting the oceans is because there's no more ice anymore. And they can actually transport on the ocean.
Right, makes it easier. And I didn't look up, I didn't think of it until now, but I know that a significant part of the revenue for Alaska is from tourism and from fisher. I mean, I know, I personally know at least five people that go to Alaska every year and fish for salmon. So, and the people like in Alaska that benefit from that, from the tourism and the money that is spent there and on, is there not a connection between if you destroy the habitat for those fish by killing them with oil drilling, that revenue will disappear as well? So it has a real ripple effect in terms of what the future of Alaska will look like, besides devastating the environment. It will kill tourism in a significant way. That doesn't make sense to me, and it's not a political issue to me. That's economics.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's one of the primary reasons why the North Aleutian Basin, Bristol Bay, offshore drilling is not allowed right now. And that's a strong argument for that region, but that argument should also span across Alaska, because Alaska, the people on the North Slope, the people in coastal communities on the West Coast and on the North Slope of Alaska, they rely on whaling. They're whaling cultures. And there's actually endangered species in those oceans, and some of them are whale species. There's walrus that are out there where they have no more ice to go on. There's polar bears, which are an endangered species. That's their habitat, the oceans. There's no more ice for the polar bears to go on. So it's insane to promote development in any of the waters offshore in Alaska, because there's so much marine life that provides food security for communities in Alaska, but also our economic base. It doesn't make sense, especially with all the impacts we see from global warming. And those are two of the biggest issues where resource extraction is moving forward. The Arctic Refuge, the Arctic Ocean, but there's also many other areas within the state of Alaska where there's threats that are similar. So that's why we say Alaska's ground zero.
It is ground zero, and you're right. You use the proper word. It's insanity. It doesn't make sense no matter what angle you take, from a fiscally sound one, from an environmentally sound one, from sustainability, even from the fact that we don't need fossil fuel. That's pretty important. We don't need oil. We really don't need oil. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned COP21, and it was kind of funny when I was doing the research for this show, because I thought, well, that was only like a year and a half ago. Well, excuse me, time flies. It was the end of December of 2015. I was like, that can't be right. But it is telling. I thought it was very interesting for me to reflect. You were there in Paris for COP21. And I want to talk, share with us how you were treated and how the issues of the indigenous people in general were treated. And then I thought, well, someone had a crystal ball, because it's only gotten worse with the new administration. Try as I may, this is not a Republican administration. This is a Trump administration. And I'm being honest, it's different. So there's, because like you said, for 40 years, there have been Democrat presidents and Republican presidents, and that land has been protected. So there's a new kid in town, and these are the new rules. So what happened at COP21? Were your voices heard? You were very much there, very present. What happened?
Yes, we were present. There was a strong indigenous delegation there. We were there with the It Takes Roots delegation of 90 plus grassroots frontline community representatives. And we had two strategies at COP21. We had an inside and outside strategy. I was on the outside strategy where we did a lot of actions, public actions, on the outside of the COP negotiations. And the inside strategy was where our activists were inside actually lobbying global leaders on the issues. And what ended up, one of the biggest things that happened while we were there was the COP21 immediately tried to strip Indigenous people's rights from the accord. And so immediately we had to fight to put Indigenous people's rights into the accord and have our voice be represented.
And I have to interrupt you. Like, what? I want to say, what? What do you mean they were stripping their rights? Like, what? Why was that even a conversation? It's so shocking to me when I read that. What do you mean they tried to strip Indigenous people's rights? Like, are you kidding? I mean, how did that even come up? I'm serious. It was so appalling to me.
Yeah, and that was one of the big issues that we had to fight on to get in there. And then in the end, we didn't achieve total success. We did get mention of Indigenous peoples and our rights in the preamble, but not in the accord.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was a failure in a lot of ways. And then another thing is, afterwards, when we look back, we realize the process closed without real, durable, lasting commitments that bring us to where we need to be. And that we have to go further than COP21. We have to be the message. We have to be the solution. We can't wait any longer. We can't hope that global leaders will do what is necessary for humanity to survive. We have to put forward our vision and make it happen. And that our vision calls for bold action to keep fossil fuels in the ground and rejecting the fundamental ideology of globalization. We are committed to the well-being of people over profit. And that's our vision. That's what we realized after COP21. We have to become. We have to make it real. And so, in a sense, a strong movement came out of COP21. That's what I feel was our achievement.
Interesting. Interesting. It was kind of like a slap in the face, and we better, like, wake up, mm-hmm. and here's what's happening. It's like, that's how I felt when I read it. I'm like, what do you mean? Strip them. It's so, like, it doesn't make sense in any part of my being. And, you know, I just want to go for a minute, like what I call, just go a little bit deeper, because to me, there's something really incredibly at risk here when it comes to the tribes and the voices of Indigenous people in general and why they need to be heard. What do you have to share that other of us don't know in terms of knowledge and what it might take to survive? If ever there's a chance, a time, an opportunity for us to be listening, now is the time. Because of the knowledge you have, because of the things that you have done to survive. And like you said, it's a marginal existence, which we're heading towards. We're not heading towards. Look around the world and see how many people have marginal existence. So, to me, it's that deeper question of people, you better pay attention, because the very people that could help us get through these challenging times that are here and help us with what, you know, might it take to survive, we're committing climate genocide. So that's, you know, that's to me the big question that has to be answered. And here's the thing, Faith, and I told you this when I talked to you a little bit before, we're going to be taking a break in about 1 minute. So I don't want you to get into the answer of that before we go to break. And then when we come back, love you to answer that question about what is at stake here if we don't pay attention. And then also, let's go into what are some of the things that have to be done in terms of concrete, effective action right now? How do we do it? And, you know, it's great to talk about policy and on, but there are some concrete things that we have to do. So I think it's worth it. And a part that I want to make sure that we get in before the show flies by is the emergence of women tribal leaders. And I mentioned to you that I have just spent time in Ecuador, and I'm very closely related to what's going on in the rainforest. And women of the world are emerging and engaging. So everybody stay here with me. Lots of really great, important conversation when we come back in about 30 seconds. Stay here with us.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for listening. It's Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World, and we thank you for being a part of it and for joining us for this first in a 5-series podcast spotlighting women leading the charge to address global warming. We believe that there is no better moment than right now to accelerate the cause of gender equality around the world, and the way that we're doing it is by raising the voices of brilliant women who are creating positive change by doing the good thing, the right thing, for all of us who call this planet home. Our guest today is one of those women. Joining us is Faith Gamil, Executive Director of Resisting Environmental Destruction on Indigenous Land, Red Oil. It's a grassroots network that was created by Alaska Natives to share knowledge, experience, and strategies to address the detrimental impacts of fossil fuel, mining, and climate change in Alaska. Faith is a board member of the International Indian Tribal Council and is a public spokesperson, press and tribal liaison, and human rights advocate. And she really knows her stuff. Faith, thank you so much for being here. So talk about why is it so important that we preserve the voices of the Indigenous people, why they have to be heard, and what's at risk if we don't do that?
Mm-hmm. I think, well, Indigenous peoples have always had an intimate connection to our natural environment. We understand that all life is interconnected, and we have been taught to have respect for all life. We're the caretakers and stewards of our natural environment. And because of our close connection to the land, we're hit first and hit hardest by catastrophic climate change. It's upsetting the balance of our ecosystem, and it affects our people's ability to sustain our livelihood. Now it's affecting everyone, and we're ringing that alarm bell, and we're saying it's time for people to wake up. Time for people to wake up. There's a crisis. We're all in crisis, in climate crisis right now. And people need to pay attention because of our connection with the land, we know how to survive. And we know what actions need to be taken now to bring balance back to natural order. Because we still follow natural laws that the Creator gave us to survive on. And all human beings once had this, but many have forgotten. and lost their way. It's time for people to realize on a spiritual level that we're connected to everything in our environment. If our environment is harmed, we're harmed. And it's just a basic principle, a basic teaching. That's why people need to listen to Indigenous peoples. We understand very intimately how to survive in our environment.
You know, to me, it is that. It is all that. But it's also the whole concept of taking what you need, not over-consuming, not wasting, not fishing and catching 10 fish and throwing 9 away because you didn't like the size or shape, whatever. It's really, as you said, a connection, a very authentic, real survival. We are one. And I know this is going to sound weird, but this week I took a tour of the landfill in our city, and it is connected because the amount of trash that is being produced in our city alone is mind-boggling. And I got very upset. I got really emotional. And I said, people think their trash goes in the garbage. That's all. That's where it ends. I just put it in the garbage, and this little green truck comes and takes it away. And to go out there and see what has to be done to just manage our trash, and it's because there is no connection to the earth. That doesn't happen where you live. They're not throwing things out and wasting things and over-consuming and buying. There's much more harmony. So that's kind of a little rant on my part, but it is that lack of connection that you spoke about. There's no connection, and that's what we need to stop our voices and listen to what people who have been doing that since time began and are still surviving. And then you're having your habitat being destroyed, not because of things you've done. You know, to me, that is what struck me is, no, you didn't have anything say in this. And so what does it look like in terms of concrete, effective action right now? What would that look like and some of the things that have to be done now to help mitigate or stop this?
One of the most concrete measures that humanity can take, leaders of the world can promote, is we have always strongly recommended a moratorium on all new exploration for oil, gas, and coal as a first step towards the full phase out of fossil fuels with a just transition to sustainable jobs, energy, environment. We take that position because of the disproportionate impacts of climate change on our communities and on our social, cultural, spiritual, environmental. All of these impacts affect us like that. That's why we take that position, and it can actually happen. We can stop it at the source, keep it in the ground. That would be a concrete measure, and maybe, if we do that now, the earth will be able to replenish itself, and we will survive as humanity. But if we continue to take and take and take from the earth, we are continuing the cycle of destruction. And I really wouldn't have a lot of hope if we continue to do what we're doing now. No. So that is a concrete measure for government.
Keep it in the ground.
Everyone can start shifting how we use energy on a daily basis. You can run your home on solar energy, wind energy. That's something we're pushing in communities in Alaska to transition off of fossil fuels to clean energy technologies in our own communities. If small Indigenous Alaska Native communities could actually survive off the grid and survive on clean energy technologies such as wind or solar, anyone around the world could do it. And we did a pilot project in my community that showed that our community could get our energy from solar energy 3/4 of the year. The only thing that has stopped us so far from actually implementing it is funding. But we can find a way and make it happen. And it's something that we're all working towards. People are talking about this in Alaska, especially tribal leaders, because we want to preserve our environment. And we're impacted by global warming.
And it's almost laughable. The money's there. I mean, you can name people that could, Elon Musk on the one hand, but there's other, the billions of dollars in profit that are realized each year, and I mean billions, by the oil companies, a reinvestment in that. And it always befuddles me, because the people that are making these decisions, they are citizens of the planet as well. And they will not be immune to the impacts of climate change. There's going to be a point where nobody can hide from it, and there will be food shortages and food deserts, and the beat goes on. So it's such a logical thing to me, besides a passionate belief that this is really in everyone's best interest. So if we may, for a minute, segue into, correct me if I'm wrong, I see a lot more in the past, even 10 years, of the emergence of women tribal leaders. And I would say I'm more familiar with Ecuador and Brazil and places in South America where traditionally women did not want that role. And now the grandmothers and the mothers, it's not the tribal chiefs who are typically men, but they are the ones that are coming literally out of the forest and going to places like Quito and really connecting with other women around the world. What's your take on that?
We are protecting our homelands. It has been the women that have always taken the lead on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Most of our leadership was from women, so it's not new to me. But I do see a lot of women now coming forward and speaking up for the environment. And I believe it's because we as women have a sacred responsibility to uphold life. That's our responsibility. That's our role. And that's what we do in our communities. And so part of that is standing up to defend life. And that's all life, including the environment. So that's why I believe the Indigenous women women in general, are standing up and speaking out, because we're defending the rights of our future generations, our children, our grandchildren, to continue to have life.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
When we were in Paris, we actually did the Indigenous Women of the Americas Defenders of Mother Earth Treaty Compact, that we were signatories to that. And we were able to bring that treaty there, and many Indigenous women from around the world were able to sign that treaty. And it's where you take accountability to stand up and defend Mother Earth from what's happening to her now.
And it's interesting to me, and one of the reasons why we decided to do this series on women and climate change is because we are 51% of the population, and climate change globally impacts women and children first and hardest. That's a reality. That's not fake news. So hearing women's voices, I think, is very affirming and inspiring to all of us, to really find our voices, because we are the keepers of the home, and in the sense of having children and the nurturers, you know, it's a very important role now more than ever. And you're right, the tribes have had strong female indigenous leaders, and, you know, it's time to rise up, everybody. Find that leadership in you and make a change.
Because it's a sacred responsibility.
Yes, yes.
For women.
Love that. Sacred responsibility. So let's talk for a minute about your thoughts about real practical solutions. Like, what are some of the things that can be done? Keep it in the ground. But you have a situation where the last 5% of the living coastline is melting. It's happening in the past 2.5 years since COP21. I'm sure you've seen a lot. Why is it so important that people listen to this and understand the last 5% of the living coastline is at risk?
So that people can take action. We all need to take action now. We all need to take action. Whether it's little things all the way to pushing government to do the right thing. Whether you're attending COP20, the COP meetings and climate negotiations at the international level, all the way down to changing your light bulbs in your own home. Any action, is a concrete measure. But putting our foot down and raising our voices to defend our future generations, that's what needs to happen now from all people. We're all impacted by climate change. This is an urgent situation. And we all have to start standing up and speaking out, calling for a just transition, calling for governments of the world to stop it at the source, keep it in the ground, calling for a moratorium and a phase out of fossil fuels. It's not going to happen if there's just a few voices saying this. We all have to collectively come together and make it happen. That's the only way change will happen. And so I've been saying this for about 20 plus years now. My message hasn't changed. And now, after 20 years, people are finally joining in and saying the same thing. And it's going to take time, but I think we're going to get there. I have hope that we're going to get there.
I think we have to get there, and your point about our time is now, and it's never been more critical. A lot of the people that I respect and I've been listening to, and something I believe myself, is there's never been a more important time, and you don't have to wait until the November elections, which you should be thinking about, because voting is going to be more critical now, maybe than ever in my lifetime. But those small everyday things, get involved in your school board. Get involved in your school, get involved in your local government, city council or board of supervisors or whatever that looks like for you, and make sure that your rights are not being stepped on, because that's what's going to happen. Nobody's going to be immune. And Faith, I couldn't agree with you more. It's urgent, it's critical, it is a crisis. And instead of going around like a chicken with your head cut off, figure out what it is you can do to be a part of the solution and the change. It's such an important message that you leave us with. So this is the end of the show, and it's like, okay, I have about a page and a half more questions, but we got a lot of really great information in, and I look forward to our show on May 3rd, From Brown Fields to Green Ones, Redevelopment Done Right. It's our local show, and then for our national show, we're doing something very different. It's a podcast from people at a local farm here called the Tucson Village Farm. And it's a very innovative partnership with one of our big community health centers. And we're calling it Takes a Village and a Pharmacy. They're doing a lot to address the health of children by helping with mostly mothers and children with healthy cooking, healthy eating, fresh vegetables, and how to have access to all of those things. So Faith, thanks for crossing my path in this walk. And thank you for everything you're doing and for being our first guest for this series. And I hope that our paths cross in person at some point on this journey.
Thank you so much for having me.
I really, really enjoyed it. So everybody, make it a great green, intentionally lived week. The world needs your voice.